Additionally, the legislation authorizes the president to establish military commissions for the prosecution of war crimes only in places of active hostilities against the United States where an immediate trial is necessary to preserve fresh evidence or to prevent local anarchy. He is prohibited from detaining any individual indefinitely as an unlawful enemy combatant absent proof by substantial evidence that the individual has directly engaged in active hostilities against the United States, provided that no United States citizen shall be detained as an unlawful enemy combatant. Any individual detained as an enemy combatant by the United States shall be entitled to petition for a writ of habeas corpus under Section 2241 of Title 28, United States Code. The Act also says, no officer or agent of the United States shall kidnap, imprison, or torture any person abroad based solely on the President's belief that the subject of the kidnapping, imprisonment, or torture is a criminal or enemy combatant, provided that kidnapping shall be permitted if undertaken with the intent of bringing the kidnapped person for prosecution or interrogation to gather intelligence before a tribunal that meets international standards of fairness and due process. Knowing violations of this section are to be punished as felonies. It amazes me that this kind of legislation should even be necessary in America. These are principles that Americans should insist their presidents not only observe, but actually believe in. Those of us who still mention the Constitution, even now, and our obligation to observe it, are sometimes answered with a curt reply, "We're at war." We are indeed fighting undeclared wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and an open-ended war against terrorism worldwide. But if the president claims extraordinary wartime powers, and we fight undeclared wars with no beginning and no end, when, if ever, will those extraordinary powers lapse? Since terrorism will never be eliminated completely, should all future presidents be able to act without regard to Congress or the Constitution simply by asserting, "We're at war"? Toward the end of 2007, Senator Jeff Sessions declared, "Some people in this chamber love the Constitution more than they love the safety of this nation. We should all send President Bush a letter thanking him for protecting us. What kind of sheep must politicians take Americans for if they expect us to fall for creepy propaganda like this?" The war on terror, therefore, has had dangerous and undesirable domestic consequences. So has the war on drugs. Saying so doesn't win any popularity contests. People's opinions on this issue are so deeply and fervently held that it can be very difficult to persuade them to revisit the evidence dispassionately. But revisit it we must. We seriously mistake the function of government if we think its job is to regulate bad habits or supplant the role of all those subsidiary bodies in society that have responsibility for forming our moral character. Our misplaced confidence in government has once again had exceedingly unpleasant results. A barrage of research and opinion, writes economist Dan Klein, has pounded the drug war for being the cause of increased street crime, gang activity, drug adulteration, police corruption, congested courts, and overcrowded jails. Drug prohibition creates a black market combat zone that society cannot control. The drug war has wrought particular devastation in minority neighborhoods, as decent parents find themselves consistently undermined when they try to teach good values to their children. When the lucrative profits from the black market and drugs make drug dealers the most ostentatiously prosperous sector of society, it is much more difficult for parents to persuade their children to shun those profits and pursue a much less remunerative, if more honorable, line of work. Putting an end to the federal drug war would immediately pull the rug out from under the drug lords who have unleashed a reign of terror over our cities. Finally, the good Americans who live there could make their homes livable once again. Although many conservatives support the federal war on drugs, an increasing number, like William F. Buckley, are skeptical. The conservative economist Thomas Sowell finds the whole thing more utopian than conservative. What would make still more sense than the current policy would be to admit that we are not God. that we cannot live other people's lives or save people who don't want to be saved, and to take the profits out of drugs by decriminalizing them. That is what destroyed the bootleggers' gangs after Prohibition was repealed. This is not an unusual perspective in the Christian tradition as well. In the Treatise on Law in his Summa Theologica, Thomas Aquinas explains, citing Augustine, that not all vices should be punished by the law. Human laws should chiefly forbid those things that cause direct physical harm to others. Aquinas offers murder and theft as examples. With regard to practices that do not physically harm or defraud others, whatever other intangible grief they may cause, it can be necessary to tolerate them if prohibiting them would lead to still further evils, a point that is especially relevant to our subject here. What is more, the law cannot make a wicked person virtuous. According to Aquinas, God's grace alone can accomplish such a thing. The law is simply incompetent here. What the law can do is provide the peace and order within which men can conduct their affairs. But so much of what is important in human life takes place far removed from law and in the domain of civil society, families, and communities. These salutary influences, apart from the state, have a responsibility to improve the moral conduct of individuals. We ought not to shirk our responsibility by looking to politicians, who are not exactly known for living beyond moral reproach themselves, to carry out so important a function.